Okay, welcome to Public Health 241, lecture, what is this? Lecture, is it nine? Okay, thank you. I don't have it written on there. Lecture nine. Okay, so we've now, last week, reviewed the idea that we want to make, we understand issues about association and independence and dependence between a simple risk factor, in this case a binary risk factor and a binary outcome in the population. We then last week spent the time saying, well, of course, we're rarely going to have the entire population to study and have data on those factors. So we talked about how we might sample, take a sample from the population and the three major variants, design variants that allow us to sample in different ways from the population and what kind of information would be available in these designs. So the variants, the population-based, the cohort study where you have separate samples of exposed and unexposed people, and the case control design. And now we're going to say, okay, given we have data from one of those particular designs, how do we actually take the information that we collect from the sample and make statements about the association between the factors D and E in the population, because that's what we care about, the target population. So we have a very small, and this is of course one of the great miracles of statistics, we'll talk about some others this week, but one of them is of course the fact that you can take information on a very small set of people and accurately describe what would happen if you had taken, in fact, the information from everyone in a very large population. That's the whole point of sampling. And of course, what makes that work is the random sampling. If you took a selected sample, what information you found out from a small group of people might tell you very little about what's going on in the population. And sampling, of course, was really born as a discipline not that long ago, in as the way these things go. It really grew in World War II, where the governments actually sort of sponsored and hired people to work on statistical issues largely to do with bombing raids, to try and make bombing efficient, essentially. How accurate were they being? Were they achieving goals and so on? And sampling techniques played a big role in that. And then, of course, it hit the heyday in presidential politics following the Dewey-Truman election. Before the Dewey-Truman election, there weren't polls, as you suffer through now endlessly. There were, in the Literary Digest, which was a magazine that I think is now out of print, sort of a precursor of the Reader's Digest, a very widely circulated national magazine, asked their readers to say who they would vote for in the Truman Dewey election, and Dewey was ahead by a large fraction in that quote poll. And of course Truman won the election, and the response was very high because people weren't inundated in those days with these kind of things. And so you had maybe, I don't know, 1 million, 2 million respondents. So you had a huge amount of data compared to a normal poll that they do nowadays, but it was completely wrong. It was off by 10 points basically. And after that, it sort of gave birth or renewed interest in survey sampling and the birth of the sort of modern polling movement to do it using random samples. And that's what's done now, is basically when you see a poll in the New York Times, the best polls have a random sample of about 1,500 people to represent the entire United States. So that reflects the power of statistics, that you can project up from 1,500 people if they're carefully chosen. I don't mean selectively chosen, carefully in terms of the randomness in the way they're chosen. You can project up with fairly high accuracy, and you can quantify the degree of accuracy, and that's going to be important to us because it's exactly the same kind of thing we want to do now, which is take a small number of people and project up to very large, potentially very large target populations, and also be able to report on how accurate our projections are. And that's what we're going to do this week. And we're going to start with the question of independence. And some of this should be review, so I'm going to go through it fairly quickly. And then towards the end of the week, some of it may not be quite as much review. And just to be convenient, I'm going to use this notation for 2x2 tables with A, B, C, D's, because I don't like N sub 1, 1 and N 1, 2's, and then, you know, and you'll see other notations in other books and software documentation, but I'm just going to use this. I like thinking in terms of letters. It's crucial in some of the formulas here now that you know which variable is labeling the columns and which variable is labeling the rows. And I'm going to now, I hope, be consistent about always labeling the columns by disease status, and the rows will be exposure status, for at least for a while. Of course, anytime you're doing this, every time I use Stata, I sort of have to remind myself with the help menu, how does Stata expect it if I'm just feeding in A, B, C, D's, because I don't remember if they do it the way I do it or different, so I always check it, as you always should, right? So it's just like me checking the gas in the car every time I get in. Is there any gas in the car? You just do it by habit. You don't think about it. I do this. So because, as you'll now guess, in some of the formulas it won't matter, and you'll see that. You might guess in estimates of the odds ratio. It's not going to matter if you get it wrong, because the odds ratio is invariant, and the estimate of the odds ratio will be invariant if you put the disease down in the rows and the exposure in the columns. But for relative risk and risk difference or excess risk, it's going to matter in the formula. So don't blindly apply these formula without being sure you know that you've got your data arranged in this format. Otherwise, you have to change the formulas a little bit. Okay? All right, so we're now going to talk about independence of D and E first, and then after today, probably on Wednesday, we'll talk about estimating the relative risk and odds ratio of things to quantify the lack of independence or the amount of dependence. But we're going to start with looking at is there sufficient information in this sample of data to make a statement about whether independence is plausible or not in the entire target population. And we're going to have this data in the way I just had up on the slide there, where we've collected by one of the designs, and we'll look at the designs in a little bit, and try and assess from this data, and we'll look at an example in a minute, whether there's evidence of independence or lack of independence or not. And we're going to start with the population-based design. So the population-based design in its purest way is just a simple random sample from the entire population of size little n. And little n, of course, is selected. Let me put a circle around it to remind you that's not random. That's selected by the designer, you, hopefully, if you're ever designing one of these studies. But the A, B, C, D's are all random variables because you can't predict beforehand what those numbers are going to be. And so the results of combining these numbers are themselves going to be random variables, and that means they're going to vary. Even if you did exactly the same experiment again, it's going to vary, and part of the statistics of assessing the accuracy is saying, well, how much does it vary given what's going on in the population? How far away from the truth could you be if just because of randomness? Now, to think about independence, we fall back on, you know, the envelope, the canonical envelope, and think, how would I assess independence? And we already did this in the first week of the class. So one of the definitions of independence tells us that if D and E are independent, it's actually equivalent to saying that the fraction of the people in the population that share both characteristics is just the product of the marginal fractions of having each characteristic separately. In symbols, P of D and E is P of D times P of E. So we looked in the first week where we looked at some of that infant mortality data and the mother's marital status at birth, we looked at P of D and E, and then we looked at the two P of D's and P of E and saw that that equation didn't look like it was being true. So what the logic here is, let's check this statement. in the sample. If that statement in the sample seems to be holding, and we'll have to decide how we assess that because things are random, but if it seems plausible, then we say, okay, since this is equivalent to independence, well, we think it's plausible DNA are independent. If we don't think that statement is plausible in the sample, we're now going to project up to the population and say, we don't think it's plausible in the sample, therefore we don't think it's plausible in the population because we picked a random sample. And we're not going to believe that randomness could have taken us this far away from the statement being true. But that's going to be part of the deal. But that's the logic of a test for independence. So now all we have to do is take an estimate. Well, how do we check this in the sample? Well, we estimate. These things are population attributes, the fraction of people in the population that have both. We have a random sample, so we can estimate that by the simple fraction in the sample. And that's easy there because over in the 2x2 table, we know the number of people who have both characteristics is symbolically represented by little a. That'll be a number, of course, when we actually have data. So it's just a, and there's n in the entire sample. So the fraction in the sample that have both characteristics is just a over n, and that's going to be an estimate. So what we're really doing here is going to be putting hats on this, and we're going to have a over n. And then we can do the same thing for p of d. How many people in the sample have the characteristic d? Well, there's a plus c, because at that point we're ignoring exposure. So that's a plus c over n. And p of e is the number of people with the characteristic e exposed is a plus b over n. So just doing a back of the envelope using your intuition, and this is what we did in the first week, we would compare these fractions. Now, if you do the algebra on this thing and sort of pool this over, that suggests looking at, and the algebra's in the book, looks at suggesting actually at AD minus BC. If you do that, if you fiddle around with that algebraically, and I say that's in the book. Just checking whether that equation says how big is AD minus BC. If AD minus BC is zero, by the way, that equation holds exactly. The more the bigger the size of AD minus BC in either the positive or negative direction, the further away these two quantities are going to be. That's just algebra. And because I don't care at this point about whether there's a greater risk of D in the exposed or a greater risk of D in the unexposed than we would expect from independence, I'm just going to square this quantity so I don't have to worry about minus signs, negative numbers or positive numbers. I don't care. In either direction, if that number is AD minus BC is large, it suggests that equation isn't true. It suggests that the marginal probabilities don't match up with what we're seeing for the joint probability. And so I can just immediately have a test in my mind is I take the data, I compute this quantity, and if it's large, I say, I don't believe that equation here is plausible in the sample, and therefore, since I've got a reasonably sized sample, I don't believe it's plausible in the population. If this is very small, that's saying this equation is approximately true, close to being true, and I'm saying, well, it's so close to being true, I certainly don't. Really, the logic is I don't have enough evidence in the data to suggest anything other than that it's perfectly reasonable that DNE might be independent. Yes? Just to get rid of the minus sign, right? Deciding if AD minus BC is big either in the positive or the negative direction, it's even in English, it's easier just to say is AD minus BC squared big. Yes? Yeah, thank you. So the real question is, what's big? That sounded also logical, and it is. I try not to say illogical things. It was a logical thing, but I didn't tell you, well, what does big mean? Now, just using your intuition, which is important to develop, you can sort of know that the definition of bigness has got to be change depending on the sample size. So just intuition, forget math for a minute, because if you saw a very big discrepancy of this in a huge sample size, right, you would say that's really convincing to me. But as the sample size is small, where things bounce around a little bit because the numbers are small, you might not be so persuaded by a big discrepancy. So we know that the idea of how big is big, to respond to your question, has got to be based on the sample size. And you can use some fairly elementary statistics that I'm not actually going to show you, because it the most elegant way of doing this involves calculus, and then it's very easy, or relatively easy, is to look at this number AD minus BC. It's a random variable. We agree? So in other words, if I gave each of you exactly the same population-based design and sample size of 500, let's say, and you did the experiment, you're all not going to get the same answer for AD minus BC, right? Because it's random. The sample is random. You're getting different people, and they're not going to look exactly the same with regard to D&E. Whatever's going on in the population, that's the problem with samples, because they aren't the entire population. You get a different answer every time. So that's the drawback of taking random samples. You get a darn different answer every time you do it. But it's a different answer that's controlled in some way by what's going on in the population and the sample size. So AD minus BC is a random variable. It's like an experiment. You get an answer. You take the measurement. You get AD minus BC out at the end, and it's different from experiment to experiment. But as we repeat that experiment, we can now describe what's the sampling distribution, what's the histogram of the typical AD minus BCs that we will see. That's based on theory. That's just like when you take samples of binomial proportions and you look at the fraction of individuals with a characteristic in a population and you take the proportion, and that's based on the binomial and distribution, and you can actually draw the histogram because there's only a finite number of possible answers that you can get, and that's true here actually too. So you could actually think of drawing the histogram of all possible answers I could get for AD minus BC and how frequently they appear. So you remember about 2 weeks ago I was talking about sampling and having a dice, and you know I should have brought my 100-sided dice in, and I say, how would I convince you what the probability of getting 73 is? And somebody said, well, just keep rolling it over and over again. So imagine just doing this experiment over and over again and counting up how many times they get AD minus BC equals 2.8. And how many times do I see 3.2? And how many times do I see 1.6? And how many times do I see minus 4.2? And just count them up. And you could sit there for a few years of your life and just do this over and over and over again, endlessly. And then you would have a histogram at the end. After you'd done it 10 million times and you were getting ready to retire, Gesundheit, you'd get this histogram. So this thing has a random variable. And the magic is, of one of the miracles of statistics, is that that histogram actually has a shape that doesn't matter what the sample size is, by and large, doesn't matter what the population is, doesn't matter what P and D and P and E and P of D and E are in this particular population, because for different problems they're always going to be different, but the shape of the histogram is always roughly the same. Well, that's kind of a miracle, right? Why should, you know, you doing an experiment here in 2009 in colon cancer and diet, and somebody doing a experiment 15 years ago on coronary heart disease and blood pressure, why would the fact that the ADB minus C histograms, if you think of repeating those, have the same shape? But they do, and that's due to what's known as the central limit theorem. And that histogram, it's a discrete little histogram. I'm a terrible artist, so I am an artist, but just a terrible one. The histogram can be very well approximated by a Gaussian curve or a normal distribution. I don't like calling it the normal, though I'll slip into that, because it's not at normal. It's really a very abnormal distribution. But that's why I prefer calling it Gaussian, after Gauss, who discovered it. But it always has that shape. Whatever the problem is, whatever the population, whatever the P and D, and pretty much whatever the sample size. Now, this is an approximation, so I'm saying pretty much whatever the sample size, because this approximation disintegrates a little bit when n is very small. as you can imagine, when n is very small, if you only sampled four people, imagine drawing the 2x2 table. There's only, you know, so many ways that you can get A, B, C, D's to add up to four that fill in that table. It's a little combinatoric problem, if you like that kind of thing, to figure out how many ways there are. But it's not very many, so the histogram is very discrete. It's got just a few boxes, and the normal approximation probably won't work too well in that case. This thing I've tried to make look similar won't be so good. But as soon as n gets actually any plausible size away from zero, that approximation works very well, and it's independent of everything. It always works. That's a miracle. I get down every day on my knees and thank God for that miracle. Because I wouldn't, you know, if I didn't have that, I'd be out of a job. It's a miracle. So this thing has a, and in symbols what we say is this thing, this little tilde sign means is distributed, has a sampling distribution, if I imagine repeating the experiment over and over, that looks like a normal distribution. Now the normal distributions are remarkable family of distributions. The normal distribution is a family, right? So it's like the jewels. There's more than one jewel in the family. There's multiple jewels, all of which bear different relations, even in my family, that bear different relations to me. And you identify those different jewels by what? How would you identify? There's several jewels at Berkeley email addresses. How would you identify the differences between the jewels? Not by the last name, obviously, but by first name, normally. And occasionally, there's another Nicholas jewel. There's a few of them running around the world, one of whom happens to be a pretty good Australian cricketer. So when you Google Nicholas Jewel, you'll see me, and then this Australian cricketer, and it's not the same person. I'm not Australian, and I did play cricket, but not as well as this guy. And he's not that far away. He's a bit younger than me. I remember at one point when I was just graduating with my PhD, a professor, a very old professor, grabbed me and was just furious at me. He was yelling and spitting at me. I thought, what have I done wrong? And he'd read in the London Times that day that Nicholas P. Jewell had just gotten engaged to be married. In those days, I don't know if they still do in the London Times, in certain strata of society, they would publish people who were getting married, people who got married, people who died, and so on. In the New York Times, you just see obituaries, right? You never see, I think, announced. Well, I guess on Sunday Times, you see, this was a little small thing, and it said Nicholas P. Jewell, and he was just furious because he was the view, he was an unmarried bachelor don in his 70s, and he thought I shouldn't publish my thesis until I'd let it germinate for about 5 years. Then I would have really thought about it, and I should publish it, and then maybe after about another 5 or 10 years, maybe take a wife. But the idea of doing that before I'd even graduated, well, of course, it wasn't me. But I finally calmed him down. I said, that's Nicholas Peter Jewell. And the middle initial was correct, but the wrong name. The Irish background comes out in my middle name. So you identify the normal distributions are a family. So even though I said the shape is the same, whatever the experiment, the first name of the normal distributions that go with different experiments usually is very different. So it's not the same jewel, it's not the same normal every time. And there's two parts. It's like having two middle names. One is the mean that goes along with that normal distribution. That's one thing that identifies it. But even that doesn't completely, just like Nicholas Jewell, doesn't completely identify a unique person. There's also the variance of the normal distribution. The mean and the variance is changing, don't change the shape. They all look the same. If you took a photograph of them, they'd all look the same, and they could all be scaled to be exactly the same. So the shape is the same, but they're different, and they're different in their location where the values typically lie. That's picked up by the mean, and they're different by how thin or fat they are. So imagine you had a name which said, I kind of like the old names used to be when they didn't have surnames. You know, surnames are a fairly recent invention. And the old name, they didn't call you by a family name. They didn't call you by first name. They just called you by where you came from and some characteristic. We know normally your occupation, right? So my name actually isn't, it's a French name. It doesn't come from being a jeweler or anything, but it came from some French word, and it was about a characteristic. Rather, you know, so they used to call you, be fat so-and-so from Coventry. That would be your name. Or thin so-and-so, right? So just think of this. This is where you come from, mu. This is where you live, what typical value. So if mu is 16, you would expect to see that histogram is going to be centered over 16. That's going to identify where that normal distribution sits. And then this is a description of how fat or thin the fellow is. Sigma squared being very large means it's a very fat normal distribution. Sigma squared being very small means it's a very thin normal. They're all normals, and that immediately you tell me where it lives and how fat it is, it completely uniquely identifies that normal distribution. And those two characteristics do depend on the context where you're doing this population-based study. All right, so saying now, coming up, there's a long answer to your question, but now I'm having to say, okay, how big is AD minus BC? Well, the logic here is we now invoke the assumption in the population that we're trying to check. We say, let's assume D and E are independent. If D and E are not independent, I can't say a lot at the moment, I will in a few days, about what this thing would be like, where this normal histogram, if I repeated the experiment, would live. It would bounce around a bit, depending on how dependent D and E are. But if D and E are independent, I know exactly where this normal distribution lives, and it always lives there, whatever the experiment, whatever there's colon cancer, coronary heart disease, whatever the outcome, whatever the binary exposure. D and E independent tells me that mu is zero. So that histogram always is centered around zero. So that's telling us, okay, the first thing we should see is, this thing, is it close to zero? That's sort of almost restating, is it big or not? So that's the right question, because if they're independent, it should be hovering around zero, but it's how far away from zero, how big is it relative to zero that we're trying to nail down. This just says the logic is right to ask how big it is, because if it's very small, if it's zero, in fact, it's saying in the sample DNA are independent. So that's the right question. Now we have to say how big it is, and of course that's the second part to the name. That's the variance, right? Because the variance will determine how common it is to get values far away from zero, which if DNA are independent, that's where it should sit. So we've now got to differentiate situations. We know we're dealing with something where the histogram is potentially centered at zero if D is independent. So if we see a value out here, 6.3, there's two possibilities, right? One is that came from a normal distribution whose mean is at zero, but it was very fat. It was so fat that seeing 6.3 is not that uncommon. That's one possibility. The second possibility is, no, that distribution is not that fat. In fact, it's a very thin normal distribution. And seeing something 6.3, it's not impossible, it's extremely unlikely. And that's going to make us suspicious that this thing is centered at zero. So the logic is, either it could be centered at zero and very fat, in which say, okay, we can't rule out independence, which has said that it should be centered at zero, or we say, no, it's a very thin normal distribution, and we reject. It doesn't make sense that this thing is centered at zero. It must be centered somewhere else to have seen a value that extreme. We can never be certain, but that's the logic. Everyone with me? So the question now, all to your question, is what's the variance? Now, the variance is an odd thing, because the variance is a description of all possible samples that you could have, simple random samples, right? That's how you got the histogram. You sat there for 30 years doing this experiment, this trial or study, over and over and over and over again. Well, very few of us want to spend our lives doing the same study 100,000 times just to get a sense of DNA being independent. We could have just done the whole population by the time it did that, right? But what else can we do? We need to know the variance of this thing. We need to know how common it is to get this value, this value, this value. That means doing all the experiments. But now the second miracle comes in. And this really is a miracle. The miracle is, I only need to see one sample to tell you what all the other samples, where they're likely to be. Now that's a miracle. That's like taking one person and from taking her, saying, I don't need to see any of the rest. From what she tells me, I can tell what all the rest of you are roughly like. Well, normally in life, that would be ridiculous. But it's the randomness in here, the fact that you've taken a random sample that allows you from that one sample to project the properties of all other samples that you could have done if you repeated the experiment next week. So I don't have to do all those repeated experiments. I only have to do it once. The first thing I do with the sample is center. You know, am I close to zero? I sort of figure out this value. And the second thing I use the sample is, I use it to tell me the variability that I would expect to see in all other possible samples. That comes from randomness. Simple, in this case, simple random sampling. And it's a miracle. Because I only need to see one sample to tell me about what all the others would look like. And that's because from the sample, I can estimate this variance, sigma squared, and get an estimate of it. And then I can see, oh, does my estimate say I'm in this very thin situation, and this 6.3 is highly unlikely? Or do, when I estimate the variance, I'm in a fat situation, and that 6.3 doesn't surprise me? And that's the answer of how we're going to determine how big is big. It's going to depend on the variance of the random variable. And that's going to be why I've spent some time on it. This is a review, hopefully, for many of you, or at least bringing back happy memories of learning these ideas before somewhere, or unhappy memories, as mine all are in statistics. And the variance, there it is. I'm going to say how you calculate that is a little bit like you get it from the binomial that, you know, you got the variance of p hat is p1 minus p over n. Remember that formula somewhere? That comes from simple understanding of the binomial theorem, and this is the same. This is just extended using a little bit of calculus to make it very easy, because this is a combination of fractions here. And there's the variance. And if you want to see that in gory detail, a little calculus, and you can get it. The one interesting thing to note here is this, by the way, but for memory, you don't need to. I never memorize formulas. It's a complete waste of time. Complete waste of brain cells to memorize statistical formulas. I will never expect any of you to memorize anything. It's a waste of brain cells. Sometimes occasionally handy to remember things because it saves you time. So if you want to memorize something because you're doing it 15 times a day and you hate having to keep looking it up again, fine, that's okay. But not. I don't memorize variance formulas. Why would I do that? I just go to a book or go to Google it and it comes back at me and I say, yes, that. I recognize that, and that's the one I want. So I have to understand that I'm seeing the right thing. So I'm not going to ask you to do that, but it is kind of interesting. This A plus B times A plus C times B plus D times C is the product of the four row and column totals. It just happens to be that. There it is. And notice, but the interesting intuition thing, it's divided by N. So there you can see that the answer of how big things are, how big the variance is clearly dependent on the sample size. And you can see how it's dependent on the sample size. As n gets large, whatever the properties are of these, how likely these values are, as n gets large, the variance does what? It gets small. It gets to be one of the thin normals. And that means for the same value here, if you kept seeing the same value, the larger the n, the more likely you can rule out a value as being big, meaning it seems to contradict that this normal sits at zero, because the n is going to get large, the variance is going to get small, and you're going to be able to rule out values that you might not have been able to rule out with a smaller n, with a fatter normal. That's the intuition. That's saying that you're seeing what should be obvious to you, that the bigger the sample, the more likely you are to find definitive evidence against independence. Now, there's a little thorn in the side of that is, D and E are never independent, exactly, in a population. Just think about it. You can't be exactly independent unless you did it by some sort of randomness. Even then, they're never going to be exactly independent. So you always have a tiny bit of dependence. So the fact that you happen to wear purple probably is correlated with, in a tiny way, with some disease outcome. If you just measured whether people wear purple clothes. Right? Just can't be absolutely independent. But the trouble is it'll be just a correlation. It'll be tiny, completely spurious, if you want. But if I take a large enough sample size, if I take N to be 10 million people in the world, that variance is going to be so tiny, I'll detect anything as being not independent. So that's why the rest of the week is important, because even when we show factors are, quote, we have evidence that they're not independent, we better quantify. What do you mean by not independent? Because some dependencies may be so tiny that it's just ridiculous to worry about them. So there is, even though having N very large is terrific, if you have N hugely large, if you're lucky you're dealing with medical records and you have N's in the 20 or 30,000, most of your tests of independence are going to show up as significant, meaning the two factors are not independent, but the amount of independence or lack of independence may be so small it would be not worth mentioning. So you have to be careful if you have very large sample sizes. So beware if you're in the FDA and you're doing clinical trials and you've got a pharmaceutical company that comes in with a clinical trial with 400,000 participants, you immediately should be suspicious of that company. Right? I haven't seen the results yet, but I'm immediately, I go rigid. I'm suspicious. Why would they have selected 400,000? That costs a fortune. So the only way, reason why they've done that is because the association, the benefit of the drug, the fact that people on the drug do better than the people on it must be so tiny that they had to go that far out to get a significant result. Well, that amount of gain in the drug is not worth it. So the FDA will reject that. So that's why you don't see huge sample sizes in clinical trials. Aside from the expense, you would never do that unless you were expecting a very, very small amount of association. And you get all that insight, by the way, that rigidity that enters me when you walk into my office with that, just comes from intuition, from that formula. I know the variance depends on the sample size by 1 over N. And so now we say this, well, what do we technically do at that point? We now turn this information, that's all the intuition, we just turn this information now into machinery that any trained monkey can do, trained parrot, whatever. Right? Because you just take AD minus BC, that thing should be approximately a normal. With under independence, that's the logic here, we're checking, does it have a mean zero? And it has a variance V that I can now estimate. And that this is actually, honest, this is an estimate of the variance because these are random variables themselves. So I can estimate that. I want to, in the old days when I was a little bairn, they didn't have computers. So we had to look up tables. In the old days, you had to buy a little book of tables. I can remember having a little book of tables of the normal distribution and the chi-squared distribution and the t-distribution. You carry this little book around with you. Whenever you did a data analysis, you had to go to the book. Now you just hit a button and something spits a p-value back at you, right? But, so the logic wasn't lost in me because what I had to do was they didn't give me tables of all the normals. There's a lot of them. Even normals with mean zero, there's a whole infinite set of different variances, so I couldn't carry that larger book. So they only give you one normal table, which is the so-called standard one, where this is one. And you have to normalize things so you can use that. So the way you do that is you divide by the standard deviation or the square root of the estimated variance. Because when you multiply a normal by a constant, it changes its variance by the constant squared. You learned that in 142, hopefully. Changes the mean by multiplying by the constant. I multiplied by a constant here, 1 over the square root of v hat. So I multiply the mean by 1 over square root of v hat. But multiplying 0 by anything is 0, so it doesn't change that. And multiplying this by the square of that gives me 1. So that's just the standard logic for turning things into what some people refer to as z values. Or you've done this kind of logic probably in other settings, if not this one. And now I have a quantity that I can compute from the data. If D and E are independent, this should look like a random draw from a standard normal. I then go and look at my tables, my trusty tables, or I press a button on the computer, and I see how much of the standard normal has values as large as 6.3 or not. And since I here I haven't done the squaring, I better take, could have been as large on that side. So the convention is you do what's called a two-sided test, because you don't care about which direction from moving away from independence you're moving. I say, well, how likely is it that I saw something as big as 6.3 on either side, either tail? And the tables of the normal give you that value. They usually just give you one and you double it. I would look up this and I get it, and that gives me what's known as the p-value. If that's extremely unlikely, I either believe I've just seen a one, if that's say 0.001, let's just say the p-value, well, let me make it a little more interesting, 0.002, let's say that. I see that. That tells me that if everything I believed is true, what I just saw should only happen to me 2 out of every 1,000 times in life. That's pretty rare. So I think, I've either been won the lottery and just saw something, well, not quite that rare, but I've even just seen something that only would happen to me 2 out of every 1,000 times I do this calculation, or there's something wrong with the logic. And the something wrong with the logic that says is that this might not have mean zero. What does that mean? My assumption that D and E are independent, which gave me that zero, is incorrect. So I've got two options, and I can either believe D and E are independent and I've just had a very unusual thing happen to me, or I can think, no, the more plausible answer is D and E are not independent and I've just seen a rather common phenomenon. And that's the logic behind this sort of frequentist p-value assumption. So most of us believe that, recognizing that if I make that step, I'm going to make some mistakes. You know, when I was younger again, there was this T-shirt that the people did for statisticians that said, "Statisticians being statistics means never having to say you're certain." And when I said that, when I was first teaching, everyone burst out laughing because they'd all just seen Love Story. But now no one laughs because Love Story is a classic, terrible movie 30-odd years ago, but when that dates me, of when I was learning statistics, Love Story was the Titanic of the, or the Avatar, I guess I should say now, of the year, and everyone went to see it, and that T-shirt came out. So you can never be sure, but I can say most of the time I'm not a believer that I've just something very unusual has happened. I'm just going to take the more plausible explanation that mu is not zero, in other words, D and E are not independent. Yes. No, I did. The moment I hadn't. Yeah, that's a two-tailed test. So now let me go back. The square. We often square it, and that just means we square this whole thing. So that gives you AD minus BC squared over V hat, which is that product of those marginals. And the square of a standard normal is what? It's a chi-squared with how many degrees of freedom? One. So it's equivalent statement to say something as it follows a standard normal means its square follows a chi-squared with 1 degree of freedom. And you'll learn about other degrees of freedom chi-squareds later, which are actually sums of squares of several normals. But this one is just one normal squared and you get chi-squared one. So most people, or often you can do this. And this automatically makes it a two-tailed because if it's large negative, if AD minus BC is large negative, the squaring it brings them all to the positive side. So chi-squared distribution is a distribution that has to be positive, obviously. The numbers are all positive. It looks something like this. It's this kind of skewed distribution, and you only compute this part, and it's still referred to as two-tailed because you've already got the other tail by the squaring, if that makes sense. And that's the chi-squared distribution that I think all of you have seen, right? Some point. And maybe this is just a review of the logic of where, rather than this just being a formula that's produced, this is the logic that's so beautiful and elegant. It's got these little components to it that allows you to take data and stretch it up to the entire population. And there's the algebra that I suppressed, but I said it was in the book. It's in the slide here. There's that A over N minus, there's that thing over there. So the difference between them, how close is this to zero? There's the algebra, which tells you that's really AD minus BC. And here's an example of it in action with the population-based study going back to the random sample of 200 infants that we were thinking about the last week and talking about the population-based design. This was the actual data I showed you as a plausible outcome of that study of birth weight and marital status. And there's the calculation. It's just arithmetic now. And most of the time, you're going to use a calculator or press a button. It's not bad to do it once in your life because it tells you how the thing is made up. There's the n sitting there. There's the a plus b, a plus c. There's the row and column totals. And there's the ad minus bc. And there's the squared. It's sort of hidden in there in that print there, but there's a squared there. And it comes to 3.04 in this case. And that number is not enormously large. So even though we looked at this, and you can see here that the rate of low birth weight in the unmarried is 7 out of 59, which is quite a bit higher than 7 out of 141 in the married mothers, the sample size 200 is sufficiently small that that variation, I think it was a relative risk around 2 point something, if I remember from last week, that isn't entirely convincing. That could happen reasonably often, even though the two factors are independent. And there's the exact quantification of what do I mean by reasonably often, 8 out of 100 times, if D and E, if marital status and birth weight are truly independent, and I ran this experiment over and over again with these marginals, 8% of the time I'd get something this big or bigger. So yeah, it's sort of borderline. And again, statistics means you can't be certain, right? I can't say they are independent, I can't say they aren't, but I'm weighing the evidence. And the evidence is suggestive, but not definitive. Okay, I'll start in the cohort study and then we'll move. Finish this off on Wednesday with both the cohort and the case control. So now we say what we just described was for a population-based study. Can we do that for a cohort study? Well, immediately the logic breaks down, because we don't know how to estimate P of D and E from a cohort study. We agreed last week that you can't estimate it because it's manipulable. The sample fraction of D and E's is manipulable by the sample sizes in the exposed and unexposed groups. And the same will be true in case control. We can't get P of D and we can't get P of E. We agreed with that. We could only get things from a cohort study like P of D given E or P of D given E bar. So that definition of that logic for determining independence or the lack thereof doesn't work. So we actually have to use a little bit different logic, and we use a different equivalent definition of independence because this one isn't available to us. So we use a different definition, which you may remember from the first week, was if those two conditional probabilities are equal, if the incidence proportion in the exposed is the same as the incidence proportion in the unexposed, that's equivalent to independence. And we'll use that now to develop a logic. We'll compute estimates of these two fellows and compare those. And we'll decide, are they very different? Is the difference between them big or small? And we're going to have to use now slightly different calculations, say, well, how big is big and how small is small? But the logic will be the basic structure of the argument will be identical. We'll just be basing it on comparing this and this rather than up here. And we'll come back to that on Wednesday.